I once had a violent argument with a fellow about Georges Simenon.
About who?
Georges Simenon.
Oh, yeah.
Maigret. Yeah. Ironically, neither of us had read him.
Oh,
the time.
You hadn't.
But he argued that Simenon is not an artist because detective fiction is not an art. He argued that Simenon is a craft.
Well, hell, he wasn't arguing about anything. Who decides what art is? So some people think that old junk riveted together is art. I mean, it's silly to talk about what is and what isn't art because everybody has his own definition. So what the hell? It's just a silly argument.
Yeah, it seemed to me a specious argument time. It sort of seemed like saying Aaron Copland is an artist and Louis Armstrong isn't. You know, one played music of the people. And
you never get anywhere with that kind of an argument. Yeah. If anybody wants to think that the old hardware riveted together is art in the same sense that a picture partition is art, if they want to think that, all right, God knows I'm not going to waste time arguing with them.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's an idiotic supposition. But if it isn't to them, all right, to hell with them.
Yeah. What is the art of detective fiction?
Well, again, when you talk about what is the art of something, you're talking about what is art.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever read a book by a man called Tolstoy, What is Art?
No, I haven't.
One of the silliest goddamn books ever written. If anybody was a great artist, he certainly was.
Uh-huh.
But when he wrote a book, he was in his 50s then. When he wrote a book called What is Art, it's just a lot of utter nonsense.
Hmm. You wouldn't want to define it, huh? You was right.
Oh, God, no. Well, I know what it means to me.
What?
I would call anything art that has in it an element of the human imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And that means, therefore, that I just wouldn't rule out any human product if it has an element of imagination in it.
Yeah.
A man can make a chair, and if somehow he gets some of his own unique personality into that chair, you could call it art.
Therefore, your house is art.
Well, all right.
What inspired you originally to become an author? An author. What inspired you originally to become an author? You've been a successful businessman.
Anybody who tries to answer that question is either dishonest or a fool. You can't possibly tell. How the hell could you know?
You were in your 40s, I think, when you first... You were in your 40s when you first started writing?
Oh, no, I started writing when I was 16.
Ah, just on the side.
I sold... the first thing I ever sold in my life was a poem to the Smart Set when I was a Kansas boy, 16 years old. So I've always been fascinated by words and loved words. And it was... probably doomed at some time or other to devote all of my time to writing.
Doomed is an apt phrase. According to Nero Wolf, nothing corrupts like writing a book. Myriad temptations are overpowering. What are the temptations? What are those temptations to write?
Depends on who you are.
Well,
the temptation of a Jane Austen to write, the impulse of a Jane Austen to write is obviously quite different from the impulse of a Marcel Proust to write.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on who you are entirely. So look at consider the impulse to write with Dickens and the impulse to write with Eric Ambler, for example. Oh my God, obviously it's a completely different thing.
Mm-hmm. What about your impulse?
Or the impulse of an Immanuel Kant to write, for God's sake. Compare that with a Bernard Shaw.
Mm-hmm. What about your impulse?
As far as I know, it was just a strong desire to tell stories. Why? I don't know. I have the faintest idea. And I don't give a damn.
Yes. You know, Baring Gould quotes you about your pre-mystery writing. I discovered I was a good storyteller, but I would never be a great writer. What's the difference?
Oh, I think it's quite different. A great writer, in addition to being a good storyteller, has got to have some kind of a unique insight into the human condition and to the problem of being a man or a woman that is a contribution, an actual contribution to the human record of an understanding of the human problem, of the human condition. Very few writers have had that. Very few painters have had it.
Who has, do you think?
Who has had it?
Yeah.
Well, Homer did, of course. I mean, the obvious ones, Homer, Dante, and Shakespeare. Shakespeare above all others. At a lower level, Dickens did. At a much lower level, Marcel Proust, that unreadable goddamn little fool, he did. Yeah, but he had something, some very peculiar thing about his attitude toward human problems. Yeah, so I'm not denying that Proust wasn't an exceptional individual, but for me as a writer, he's impossible. I just can't read the poor goddamn bore. Terrible.
Aren't you convinced by all the adulation aren't you convinced yet by all the adulation that you're a great writer?
Oh, good God, no.
No? You don't think you have
no any man should be convinced by anything that is said about him when he's alive. The only test of whether a man is really, really exceptional or not, it comes through the years. Can't possibly come during his lifetime. Look at all the misjudgments that have been made by contemporary critics of people who write or paint, or look at all the idiotic performance about a guy named Picasso, obviously incredibly overpraised. Everybody considering him on the same level with the very greatest, with the Leonardo and the Titian. Well, that's just a lot of goddamn, I think, bullshit. I think it's silly. I'm not saying he wasn't a man with great talents, and maybe even some streaks of genius. But to think that he was great in the sense that a Velázquez was great is just too nuts.
What is genius? Have you ever thought about it?
Well, again, semantics, again, a word. Well, what genius is depends entirely on who taught, who's using the word. Of course, you know, who was that says genius is the something of taking infinite pains? Was it Dickens? Who said that? You know, somewhere along the line said that. Well, that's what he thought. Of course, I don't think so at all. I don't think Shakespeare ever took infinite pains with anything. He didn't have to. But of course, in talking about art, talking about anything, it's always silly to mention Shakespeare because Shakespeare was pure magic. Nobody has the faintest idea why that man could do the incredible things he did.
That's right. Your first published novel was How Like a God.
Yeah.
What was that? What was it about? I haven't seen it. You can't find it very much.
It was a damn good book with severe limitations, but within its limits, it was very good. In the first place, it was an interesting technique. The story opens with a man going upstairs at night in an apartment house in New York, and he's doing something that everybody does once in a while, talking to himself. Haven't you ever said to yourself, well, you damn fool, why did you do that? In that sense, this guy's talking to himself. And he starts talking to himself, and he starts saying, well, why are you actually, well, why are you going up there? And that's what the whole book is, the guy talking to himself for 300 pages, which is a very interesting technique.
Yes.
And how well did I pull it off? I don't know. We have good reviewers like Clifton Fadiman, and Fraser thought I did a good job of it. I don't know.
How did you?
I know that Bertrand Russell and Havelock Ellis both thought it was a good job. And they're people, or were people, whose opinions are to be respected at least, whether they're always right or not. At least they had a little sense about such things.
You wrote to, I think, what, four or five more before you wrote to Fair de Lance.
I wrote one called Seat on the Wind, which Christopher Morley thought was the best novel an American writer ever wrote. Well, that was silly. It wasn't. But anyway, it got pretty good reception.
What is the best novel an American ever wrote, according to you?
Probably Moby Dick. If I had to pick one and vote for that, I think it'd be Moby Dick. I think it'd have to be. Of course, you could sit and argue for an hour about trying to decide whether it's Moby Dick or Huck Finn.
Mm-hmm.
But where would it get you? It wouldn't get you anywhere.
Did you have a particular vision at that time you were trying to communicate in your early novels? Did you have a central idea you were trying to communicate, or a philosophy you were trying to communicate?
I've never learned a philosopher. I haven't got one now. At the age of 87, I haven't really got a philosophy. If philosophy is a settled idea as to what are the basic rules about human conditions and human problems and how to handle them, is that what a philosophy is? I haven't really got one, because it keeps changing on me. It depends. For instance, my idea of what might or might not be necessary or possible to do regarding an incompetent president of the United States is not the same today as it was 10 years ago on account of Richard Nixon. I'm inclined to think now the only thing to do with him is take him out and shoot him.
that's revolution.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Because he's such a slippery little bastard. If he's merely a boob like a Harding, then it's a rather easy answer to the problem.
Mm-hmm.
But when he's such a horrible eel as Nixon, I don't know. I don't know what you're going to do except shoot him.
I was speculating earlier. What would Nero Wolfe do about the Watergate? You know, how would he investigate it?
I don't see how you could do anything except just say phooey. Well, what else can a man do?
Well, speaking of Nero Wolfe, how did you evolve from a so-called writer of, quote, serious fiction to a writer of mystery fiction?
There was no evolvement concerned. What do you mean evolve?
Well, you were writing suddenly you began writing mystery novels.
Well, I was telling stories, and in telling the stories, I was deliberately trying to express an attitude or something about the human condition, the human problem, and men, and what they're like, and what they should or should not do. Well, I started writing detective stories on account of the very technique of the genre. I just abandoned that idea entirely and merely tried to tell a good story. If in the process of telling a good story, if you happen to create a character that people like, it is all right, then you do happen to, but that's a byproduct. Your basic interest, the one thing that you are determined to do is to tell a good story.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to create the characters, Nero Wolfe and Archie Goodwin and
I don't know, 5 minutes, I suppose, or
really?
3 minutes.
Really? In all their detail?
Nero Wolfe is, I call it the two kinds of characters in fiction, either drama or narrative. I call them created and contrived. E.M. Forster called them round and flat. You can call them anything you want to, but the one kind of character is the kind that is not made up at all. The author who uses that character, who makes him, has never asked himself a question about that character. The character is just there. And the two kinds of characters in all fiction, it's always easy to tell which it is. It has nothing whatever to do with the level of literature. Hamlet, of course, was a created character, so was Tarzan.
Mm-hmm.
In Gone with the Wind, Scarlet O'Hara is a created character. The guy, the man, what's his name?
Red Butler.
Yeah, he isn't. He's obviously contrived. And reading the story, you can tell that easy. In reading Dickens is full of both kinds.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always so goddamn easy to tell which is which. Sam Weller is obviously created.
So, you
know. No, I heard how she'll answer it. She'll answer it.
So Nero Wolfe is a created character.
That's right. And therefore, I can't really answer any question about the guy. I'm not just trying to be cute or something. I just can't. He was there, and that's that.
Hmm. The obvious question, a question I'm sure you're maybe bored with altogether, is how much of you is in those characters, in Wolf and in Archie Goodwin? You have gardens, but not orchids.
Do you think any writer can ever honestly answer that question? You think he knows? I don't think he does. It's like thousands of other questions, so easy to make up an answer. Mm-hmm. But a made-up answer isn't of any importance or any value to anybody. Sure, I could make up an answer, but it would be phony. Obviously, any character in any book by any writer, contrived or created, comes from the man himself or woman and all the things he's ever heard and done and heard and said. Of course, that's where it comes from. Where else could it come from?
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, to some extent, every character in any book, a part of it at least, is a part of the person that wrote the book.
Mm-hmm.
But of what significance or importance is it to try to discover how much of it comes from the man himself? And who gives a damn?
Yeah.
I mean, the character is either interesting and worth knowing for itself, for himself, or he isn't.
Mm.
And you see, to me, nothing ever written about a story is worth reading. Only the story is worth reading. Nothing ever written about Homer, to me, is worth reading.
Mm-hmm.
It may be amusing, good entertainment, but I mean, to give you insight or understanding or anything, it isn't worth a damn. With Homer, the thing to read and the thing that's important is Homer, not anything that anybody ever wrote about him.
And the important thing is to read the book for what it will give you, and not what it gave to someone else.
Yeah, that's even, if anything, it's even truer of Dante.
Mm-hmm.
To read the Divine Comedy is a wonderful experience. To read anything anybody ever wrote about it just doesn't amount to a damn. Utterly unimportant. Unless it happens to be good writing and you enjoy good writing just for the sake of good writing. If you enjoy words well put together, just you enjoy watching a good chess game, all right, fine. I'm not talking about that.
At the popular culture convention earlier this year, at the popular culture convention early this year, there was a paper delivered on the moral vision of Dashiell Hammett, and a lot of talk about
bullshit,
and a lot of other talk about morality. Do you sense that there's a sense of morality in your novels?
I don't think anybody could possibly write a novel without a sense of morality being in it. How could they? Because every man who undertakes to be articulate to the point of putting words together for print, he must have a sense of morality, hasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
How could he be without one? And therefore, it's in his book. Whether the sense of morality expressed in his book is his, or an attempted refutation of his, or what, I don't know. But there'll be a sense of morality in it. Take an utterly amoral book, like Ronald Furbank's Prancing Nigger. Did you ever read that?
No.
Beautiful job. An awful book, but a beautiful job of writing.
Mm.
The most completely amoral book I've ever read.
How so?
Nobody in it is in the slightest degree interested in any moral judgment of anything they say or do.
Mm.
I don't know that I could name another book that that's true of.
What is the sense of morality in your novels?
What is the sense of morality?
In your, yeah.
I think it's a sense of what is either acceptable or admirable human conduct. Isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Who's the arbiter of that, of what is acceptable?
Oh, it depends on who you are. If you're Roman, if you're a devout Roman Catholic, then the goddamn priest around the corner is an arbiter.
Mm.
If you're a complete skeptic, then there really is no arbiter, not even yourself. Who the arbiter is depends entirely on who you are.
In the myth of society, the law is presumably the arbiter of justice.
Well, there you are.
And therefore,
in the myth of our society, the Judeo-Christian ethic is the basis of our moral decisions.
The law is not always the arbiter of justice
no,
in your novel.
No, he is not by any manner.
Nero Wolfe often is. what do you think about the law? Is the law inadequate in America? Has it changed?
Oh, certainly it's inadequate. It's pretty good. We probably have certainly as good a body of law and handling of it in this country as anywhere in the world, I should think. I don't know of any country that has a better one.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I can claim a complete knowledge of the body of law in every country, but like everybody that reads, I know a little about it, and probably we have as good a one as anybody.
Mm-hmm. What about the FBI, though? And the doorbell rang, of course, which tripled your fan mail, presumably, and is considered by many your best Nero Wolfe novel. The FBI is the butt of it.
Yeah, well, that man Hoover was really a remarkable man. In some ways, a very contemptible and condemnable man, and in some ways he was damned efficient, damned competent. He did, for instance, a remarkable thing. For 40 years he kept the FBI out of partisan politics. And that's a quite remarkable thing. Look what happened to it after he died. Immediately it was in partisan politics.
Mm-hmm.
The temptation to permit such an organization concerned with crime and so on, the temptation to let it take a hand in partisan politics is almost irresistible. By God, that man Hoover, much as I condemn him for some things, he did that. Remarkable.
Did you know him?
I met him once or twice. I didn't know him.
Did he read your books?
He read The Doorbell Ring. How do I know that? A pretty good friend of mine, who was then a vice president of General Foods, had been for 14 years an FBI special agent, and still had friends in the organization,
mm-hmm.
and they told him about it.
Hmm. Do you know what his reaction was?
He didn't really have one personally, but he left the idea as to whether they should try to do anything about it or me, any kind of a reply or anything at all, to two other guys in the organization. They decided, no, there's no point in it.
You weren't investigated or anything?
Oh, they had a big dossier on me already, of course.
Why?
Well, I'd been chairman of the Writers' War Board, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been condemned by the House Un-American Activities Committee for another thing.
Why?
Chiefly because I was such a strong advocate of world government.
Hmm. Yeah, that's another point. You, Wolfe, and always there was a relation. Wolfe always speaks of his responsibility as a citizen, and you've embraced the responsibility as a world citizen. I mean, you've been on the Writers' War Board, the Friends of Democracy, the Authors Guild, the Society for Prevention of World War III, Freedom House, and the Writers' Board for World Government. What is your involvement with all of this? What?
A dislike of both incompetence and and hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I do not believe in revealed religion at all, but I have a strong Quaker background. All eight of my great grandparents were Quakers. Mm-hmm. In my bloodstream, I'm all completely Quaker. My attitude toward public and social problems is pretty damn Quakerish now. Still is, although I don't believe in revealed religion at all.
Does it upset you that Nixon is a Quaker?
Oh, no. Well, what the hell, he isn't. His forebears were, but he never was. His parents were.
What is the responsibility of a citizen in America? Or in the world?
I want to try to make himself a... If he isn't a non-entity in the human stream, if he's going to be either an asset or a liability, to be an asset instead of a liability, to make it a good thing instead of a bad thing that he was born and lived, either in a very, very tiny way or in a very big way. If you're just the average guy, in that respect, you really don't exist. You have no effect whatever on what happens, on whether your society is a decent society or not. If you're a justice of the peace, you may have a tiny effect. If you're a John Berryman, you have more effect. If you're an Earl Warren, you have still more effect. It just depends on how what you were born to, on what your capacity is, and what you were fitted for, and how well you perform.
As a writer, you dedicated yourself during the war to the war effort.
Hmm?
You dedicated yourself to the war effort in World War II. I believe you wrote Propaganda, didn't you? Or were you involved?
As a chairman of the Writers' War Board, I had a good deal to do with that, yeah.
And of course, you edited the illustrious Dunderheads, which...
Yeah.
How did people react to that?
Well, the illustrious Dunderheads was one of the things that the House Un-American Activities Committee had against me. Because it claimed that especially one communist member, a pro-communist member of Congress, that I didn't condemn him. Mm. Which showed that I myself was a fellow traveler. Of course, it didn't at all. That wasn't what that book was about. That book was about the attitude toward the Nazis.
Yeah. I thought it curious, in one of your books, Nero Wolfe refers to Stalin and McCarthy in the same breath, and I, as I recall, refers to them as vermin. You believed that, I assume.
Yeah, I don't think it's too strong a term. Certainly not for McCarthy.
How did you...
Well, maybe Stalin was too powerful a man to make it reasonable to call him vermin.
Do you still see that McCarthy thing happening today? And that kind of persecution, suppression of ideas.
Could happen? Well, certainly, at any time it could happen anywhere. If that kind of a man hits the right moment and acts the way that will be effective in that moment, sure, of course it could happen again.
Mm-hmm. Were you accused of being a communist?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
How did you weather the investigation?
Paid no attention to it.
Was there an attempt to blacklist you?
Ignored it. Several times I was invited to defend myself against the accusations and so on and so on. I just refused saying about it. The hell with it. It was obviously silly. I knew damn well it was silly because I knew that I myself have always had a strong contempt for communism, even as a even as an economic and social doctrine, and as a help in ruling a country, as a background, as a basis for governing a country, it's obviously ridiculous nonsense. And I've always felt that.
What's the responsibility of a writer in society?
The same as a filling station attendant. Mm. There's no special responsibility of a writer that I know of. Why should there be? Who would impose it?
Mm.
Who would say so? Who could prove it?
Do you feel that Dalton Trumbo and the Hollywood Ten and the people that were blacklisted and hurt by that committee,
yeah,
were they martyred?
The Hollywood Ten?
Were they martyrs to the cause or something?
Well, martyr is a very strong word. I think martyrdom means that to deserve the epithet of martyr, I think you have to deliberately sacrifice yourself to some cause or some purpose and permit yourself to be fatally damaged on account of your service to that cause. I don't think that is true of Dalton Trumbo and Albert Bessie and those other guys. I think that's giving them a little too much honor. I don't think they quite deserve to be called martyrs. But that word martyr, like all words, is often loosely used. So mm. I wouldn't call them martyrs, no. I don't think they deserve it.
Mm. Throughout your novels, you speak, and I think one of the great things about your novels is they have a timeless and yet contemporary character, that they always take place when they were written, and you refer to books of the time and people of the time. Presumably, were these books and these people you referred to people you were responding to yourself at the time? I know Steinbeck, Rachel Carson, were praised by Wolfe. Was this your way to praise them?
Hmm?
Was this your way to praise them? To praise Steinbeck?
Actually, I think so, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It presumably, and apparently, was just a part of establishing the kind of man Nero Wolfe was. Mm-hmm. But almost certainly, unconsciously, after all, like everybody else, I'm not on speaking terms with my subconscious. and therefore, I never know really what it's up to. But probably that was it. Yeah.
What's that quote of Wolfe about the subconscious?
Hmm?
The subconscious is not a grave, it is a cistern.
Oh, yeah.
I think there's a famous, it's not in one of the books I've read. I've read about 40-something of them. I think there's 69 individual Nero Wolfe stories. In one of them, he has the famous scene where he burns the Webster's Third International Dictionary.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a big intellectual argument when that came out.
Mm-hmm.
Did you burn your copy?
As a matter of fact, I gave it away. I thought it was kind of a pity to burn it, and I happen to know a guy that thought he wanted one, and I certainly didn't want mine, because I think it's really a contemptible book.
Why? I never understood that.
Any book that, well, maybe contempt isn't right, maybe contemn is what I mean. I think any book that does damage to our language is a bad book.
Mm.
And I think it did damage to our language. Any book that says such things as that ain't is often used by educated people, it's just a goddamn lie. And there are quite a few similar lies in that book. It just isn't true.
Mm.
It's a false book.
As a writer, did you consider it a threat to yourself and to your art?
To something I love, the English language.
Mm. One of the books you praise...
You see, the English language can do certain things that no other language, not that I'm a great linguist, but from what everybody has said and people with no language know, the English language can do certain kinds of things that no other language could do. Take Shakespeare's that come before the swallow dares and take the winds of March with beauty. Take that phrase, and take the winds of March with beauty. You can't, apparently you can't do that in any other language.
The image of the rhythm.
Now, if you ask me to explain precisely and understandably exactly what I mean, I can't. I admit I can't. But there's a certain effect that those words have. The words make no sense whatever, obviously. If I'm asked to explain, everybody's asked to explain, what do those words mean, and take the winds of March of beauty, you can't possibly do it. They don't mean anything. But it's a very beautiful phrase. It's a very beautiful thing, and it gives a very beautiful feeling, a very beautiful impression. And apparently no other language can do that. People don't know language. Just tell me that it can. Say that it can.
You feel protective toward the language.
Hmm?
You feel protective toward the language?
You're goddamn right I do.
Would you throw me out if I use contact as a verb?
No, you weigh too much.
One of the books praised by Wolfe about 15 years ago is a book by William Kunstler.
By whom?
William Kunstler, lawyer.
Yeah.
How do you feel about him now?
Well, what book was it?
The Minister and the Choir Singer.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was the... Kunstler had done no other thing like that. Did you ever read that book?
Uh-uh.
That was merely a detailed report in the manner of a William Roughhead of a murder and a trial. And it was a beautiful job of reporting. But other things that Kunstler has done aren't reporting at all. They're adversary work, and certainly not, in my opinion, not always admirable, and not always effective. I think he's done a lot of stupid and silly things. But that book was a hell of a good job of writing, of reporting. That's what it was.
What do you think of civil disobedience?
Hmm?
What do you think of civil disobedience? Not just Thoreau, but the sort advocated by Kunstler and other people as a reaction. It's not exactly taking Nixon out and shooting him, but presumably.
Well, Thoreau's a pretty bad example because he was a goddamn faker. Hell, he would lecture Emerson on not being as simple as he should be, and then he would go to... When he got a little tired of eating the goddamn stuff he ate at his little cabin, he'd go to Emerson's house for a very wonderful Sunday dinner. Thoreau was not an honest man. Well, why is he so great? He admired and so on, because he was a damn good writer. No other reason. He was a goddamn faker. There wasn't an honest drop of blood in that guy's veins. He was completely a faker. He was a hell of a good writer. To take one of his famous utterances, most men live lives of quiet desperation. What's a lot of goddamn nonsense? Most men do nothing of the sort. Now, how many men do you know, or women, that live lives of quiet desperation?
I know some.
Some, certainly. So do I. But he didn't say some, he didn't say a few. He said most men live lives of quiet desperation. Well, nuts. In the first place, most men do not have enough awareness to live a life of quiet desperation. They don't know enough about what's going on. They don't realize how unlucky or how something they are. They haven't got sense enough to live lives of quiet desperation. To live a life of quiet desperation is quite a job.
How do you feel about civil disobedience?
Any man has a right to engage in civil disobedience if he's willing to take the consequences. But when he does so and then yells that he wants amnesty, why, the goddamn coward. That's what he is. That's what all these kids are that ran away from the war and then demanded to be forgiven immediately. I have nothing but contempt for such people. Now, am I saying that they should be punished all the rest of their lives? No, but they might at least have kept their mouths shut for a few months.
Mm.
until our soldiers that came back and tried to do something, the poor bastards, until at least as long as they're still licking their wounds and trying to get jobs, they might have kept their mouths shut for a little while, I should think.
Do you feel a country, a political system, has the right to expect a man to risk his life?
I think it has to. Whether it has a right, you might say, do I have a right to? Certainly, it's a right because it's a right because it's inevitable. You can't have an organized community without that. Possibly.
Who else?
It's one of the perhaps regrettable, even maybe deplorable, elements of an organized society. In any organized society, lots of things are bound to happen that are rather too bad. It's too bad they have to happen, but they do.
Who else do you think were fakers like Thoreau, but maybe good writers in the same sense?
Oh, hell, I'd have to think about it. Who else was a faker like Thoreau? Well, I'd rather say name one that I don't think was a faker.
Okay.
Rousseau. Oh. Rousseau's basic attitude toward the human condition was the same as Thoreau's, you know. But Rousseau was a faker. Rousseau really believed it. Have you ever read The Social Contract?
Some, yeah.
Yeah. Thoreau really believed that and felt it. I mean, Rousseau. Thoreau did not.
Mm.
Thoreau was merely didn't like the responsibilities of the human condition. And he tried to avoid them, tried to sneak out from under them.
What American authors have contributed, have seen into the human condition, have contributed something to us?
Well, Mark Twain is. Saw into it, but only about a quarter of an inch. Because the poor bastard was never a man, he was always a boy. He was an adolescent to the day he died.
Mm-hmm.
I think Dashiell Hammett saw further into it than Hemingway did, because Hammett and Hemingway really were, in what they wrote, were always trying to do the same thing. We're trying to show a man confronted with the impossible problems, but dealing with them manfully and courageously. That's what they both tried to do in everything they wrote. Hammett, I think, did it much better than Hemingway did. I think Hemingway botched it terribly. Then why is he spoken of so much and regarded so highly and so on and so on? Because of his good writing. Same with Bernard Shaw, who was a jackass. Bernard Shaw was impossible of connected thought. He said, Bernard Shaw had probably written the silliest things of any man in this century, but also the wittiest things. Good God, he was witty.
Mm-hmm.
And on account of that, he is highly regarded for things that he shouldn't be highly regarded for. Same as Thoreau, a man who uses words really well can get credit for a lot of things that he doesn't deserve credit for, all merely because he uses words well.